Welcome to the AngelPool conference call. This is Michael Price of CEO Ventures. I serve as the 2011 volunteer chair of AngelPool.org, and I'll be the moderating today's call. We have an excellent panel today, which will be discussing best practices in minimizing fees safely and reducing closing costs. A quick housekeeping note before we begin. Everyone is currently in mute. A number of questions were submitted in advance that we will work our way through, but if you have any burning questions during the first part, please just simply hit star 6 to unmute your mic and go ahead and ask your question. By the way, please barge in and don't be shy, as it's typically a fairly loud group. Just please be sure to hit star 6 again after asking your question so that the background noise does not get out of hand. After the panelists' remarks, I will then remind everyone how to unmute their phones again to ask questions. Just remember to hit star 6 again right after you ask your question to, again, reduce the background noise. For those joining the call for the very first time, AngelPool.org is an organization of volunteer leaders who help angel groups across North America and is dedicated to helping their leadership build strong angel groups in their cities to drive jobs, innovation, and exciting new companies. For those angel groups that need additional capital to complete a seed round or that would like access to more deal flow, the AngelPool Syndication Network is now the world's largest, providing easy monthly access to a large number of other angel groups and deals within their region. This also provides the members of each angel group total visibility into all the best deals in their region. AngelPool.org also organizes a number of different events and best practices to lift each other's angel skills and knowledge. This ensures each angel group and their angels better fulfill their mission of helping entrepreneurs be more successful so that our portfolios in turn will also be more successful. With that, let's go ahead and begin. Again, today's topic is best practices in minimizing fees to safely reduce closing costs. The panelists are in alphabetical order, Angel Capital Group, Rachel Qualls in Hendersonville, Tennessee, Delaware Crossing Investors Group, I'll apologize in advance if I'm butchering your last name. I believe it's Sigeti of Doylestown, PA.
Good
deal. Horton Corporate Counsel with Michael Horton in Atlanta, Georgia. Tri-State Ventures, Sam Clubfish in New York, New York. And Twin City Angels, John Alexander in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'll ask each panelist to briefly introduce themselves to the group for a quick minute, and then we'll go ahead and begin the panel. And also for those who are involved with an angel group, which I think is most of you, could also maybe mention to John's earlier point, just a quick structure of it, whether it's a fund or a group, and how you currently cover legal and other closing costs. If you can just address that for just a couple of seconds, that would also be helpful to the listeners. So with that, Rachel, since you're first alphabetically, would it be okay if I asked you to go first?
Sure. So we're not a fund. We actually consist of five different, we call them chapter locations. We have chapters in the state of Tennessee, Mississippi, and then Kansas City, Missouri, and New Orleans. We're currently working on the New Orleans chapter. We all invest as one large group, so we're not geographically specific. I don't know. I guess that about covers it.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you, and welcome. Liz?
Thank you. Delaware Crossing Investor Group is also a network, not a fund. We have two chapters. One is near Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. One is near Princeton, New Jersey. Delaware Crossing symbolizes the river, so we have a chapter on each side. We are regional. We invest in companies principally in Delaware, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, New York, sometimes Connecticut. Basically our funding comes from membership fees. Sometimes we get some reimbursements from companies, and, of course, the company pays that once the deal is going forward. Often the company pays the council fees. And we also have a new retainer arrangement we started, but we can talk about that later.
Okay, perfect. Liz, thank you. Michael Horton?
Yes, I guess I'm the odd man out here. I do not manage an angel group. I'm an attorney. I am involved in particular one angel group here in Atlanta where I serve on the board. And I describe myself as a recovering big firm attorney. I spent most of my life with some very large firms, first with Solomon and Cromwell in New York, Harris, and then 25 years with a firm called King and Spalding here in Atlanta. And about 25 years ago, oh, no, no, about 10 years ago, I basically retired from the King and Spalding partnership to set up a small firm that focuses entrepreneurial growth companies. It's a virtual firm, and the whole purpose of the firm was to try to provide kind of these small entrepreneurial growth companies with a big firm experience, as I say, without the marble and mahogany. And we do all our legal work for fixed fee.
Good. Thank you, Michael. And by the way, I paid a lot of fees to King & Spalding 3 years, so the braces on your kids, that was me. Okay. Sam Klepfisch with Tri-State. Very good. Sam, go ahead. Go ahead.
We're an angel group, again, out of fund, members in the Tri-State area, the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and anywhere else that is considered Tri-State within that region. And we tend to have our fees negotiated with various attorneys and firms that like to do business with us, and generally is viewed as an investment on their end in terms of their fees, in terms of future business from those companies.
Okay, Sam, thank you. And last but not least, John Alexander.
Yes, Twin City Angels is based in Minneapolis, St. Paul, although we invest anywhere we can drive to, which includes Wisconsin, the Dakotas, Northern Iowa. We've been as far south as St. Louis, Missouri, and worked in things in Canada that we've not invested in. We're a six-year-old organization. We did our first fund in 2006, invested in 12 companies. We're now a third of the way through our second fund. I guess we are unique in that we actually have a fund. Our members contribute the same amount each into a common fund and then can put additional capital into particular companies that they like. Each member is responsible for contributing a very small amount of time in order to facilitate screening and due diligence. And we have either contributed legal support free of charge or have flat rates for legal, tax, accounting, website management, everything that we could identify. So we're as close to zero overhead as we can manage in order to get the maximum amount of capital into the individual companies.
Good. Welcome, John, to the call.
Hey, Michael. Michael,
yes.
This is Clayton White. I'm here also. I just got on a little late.
Oh, okay, perfect. Clayton, yes, if you would introduce yourself to the group, that would be great, too.
Yeah, I apologize for being a little late. We're actually on a family vacation. We run a little late. My name is Clayton White. I'm a South Coast Angel Fund, and I guess we're a little bit of the odd man out also. We are a fund, not a network. We're headquartered in New Orleans and cover the state of Louisiana and the Gulf Coast of Mississippi and Alabama.
Okay, well, welcome to the call. Why don't we begin with negotiations with the attorney firms and also with you know, any others such as accounting and bookkeeping firms. I'm not sure, you know, maybe we just start in the kind of the same order or sequence, but then we can get more informal as we go. Maybe each person can kind of discuss, you know, how they've negotiated and how they currently cover those fees and any tips that they've done to negotiate. Rachel, can I put you on the hot spot again?
Sure. So, you know, I'm only going to speak to deals that we lead, because obviously if we follow someone else handles the majority of that. But, you know, just to address that, if we follow a deal, we will typically only engage our attorneys for review, and that's usually only about $1,500. So just to speak to, if we're leading a deal, we spend a lot of time and, you know, quite a bit of money establishing two sets of standardized documentation for companies that we basically require them to adopt. So we have them for LLCs and we have them for C-Corps. We prefer LLC structures. We found quite a significant tax benefit in the first couple of years, especially for seeding the investment to LLCs. You know, within that, we have, like I said, we spend the time and effort to structure kind of a template and standardized documents that we apply to almost all of our portfolio companies. And, of course, you know, you can argue that every deal is different, and although that is true, there also are some very standardized terms that can be used for most companies. We have a ceiling of $5,000 of reimbursement expenses for every deal that we do, but that includes due diligence fees, and then our attorney fees in that are $2,500. So this probably doesn't make us the most popular clients that our attorneys have. But, you know, we basically go through the whole process of standardized docs, and then at the end, if there's something that needs to be added or if there's, you know, some very unique term that we need, we would engage our attorney at that time. But we have a maximum per deal threshold of $2,500.
Okay, that was also very useful that you mentioned the kind of the pricing that that you're paying, which I think the others will find useful as well. So I heard $1,500 on the review when you're not leading, and you know, $2,500 up to a $5,000 cap if you're doing the lead, right?
Well, it's a $5,000 cap of total reimbursement, which includes $2,500 that would come to the Angel Capital Group that we, you know, basically book out as due diligence, and we also do. We do HD green screen recordings of all of our companies that are presenting. So we have built-in costs. The $2,500 is built-in for legal.
Okay, got it. Thank you for that clarification. All right, Liz, you know, maybe mention how you currently negotiate your you know, legal and bookkeeping and other types of fees during your closings.
Sure. Once again, I think it does depend on whether we're following. If we're following, often we have a we just let our fees fall under a retainer arrangement we have with one firm. And in full disclosure, I'm also an attorney as well, and I do often represent Angel Group, so up here in the Northeast area. So I see both sides of the coin. And as an attorney, one problem I have with controlling costs and as an Angel Group is I don't think – we often syndicate with other groups, and I think sometimes the groups here are not very good at really truly being standard. I mean, I think that's great that the Angel Capital Group has standardized documents that they're really able to enforce, and I think that is something that can really bring fees down. But very often I find around here, especially in syndications, that people really are changing around the terms, especially when you get to employment arrangements with founders, investing arrangements. Often that's just a change in numbers, but often that gets very involved, and that can often put a strain on the negotiation of legal fees. So I think if a group really can be standard, I think that's great. We do have a retainer arrangement with it is my firm, but it doesn't have to be. There's no requirements in our group, but right now that's what it is. We're, for the whole year, we've put a cap on the fees where we're doing term sheet negotiations, you know, early stage term sheet negotiations, if we're following on a deal. Review of documents that other lawyers are preparing would be included in that. Also, legal work for the group to the extent there's LLCs being created and everything else. It all comes into a batch because we found that our members were afraid to call a lawyer and really weren't using a lawyer when they should use a lawyer. So basically our firm caps an hourly amount, not an hourly, caps a monthly amount. It's about $2,000, but if it's less, it's less. So our hope is that it will be less because I'm also paying that amount myself as a member and an active, you know, investor. So that takes out a lot. So only really when we're leading a deal and it's gotten beyond term sheet stage do we even have to worry about what a legal fee would be.
Very good. What kind of range do you see that is very typical in the Northeast?
Well, keeping in mind that our documents are not well standardized, for a Series A, where there's, especially if there are employment issues, I'd say it's more like $7,000 to $10,000 that the company is paying is capped usually at 10 or 8 or 10.
And then usually pretty much quite a bit cheaper on the seed?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Also cheaper for convertible if you're doing convertible debt. So Series A is more expensive. And also remembering that usually that's more than one group. And I find also sometimes these fees are capped. Recently we had the experience where the lead group had negotiated, I think, a $7,000 cap with their attorneys for a Series A. There were three or four groups in the deal, and halfway through the deal, you know, there came out a big letter that this law firm was saying that they are not representing any other firm, any other angel group. They were not representing the angel groups as a whole, but only that one angel group. And we all sort of just had to decide whether to go off and talk to our own lawyers, too. So lawyers are reducing their exposure by only representing the lead group and really not trying to deal as little as possible with the other investors, even if they're putting a significant amount of money into the deal.
Yeah, I guess each additional group or investor is additional liability piled onto it, isn't it? On the seed range, any gut feel for that in the Northeast?
We've been mainly doing the Series A recently. We haven't done so much seed. We do have one seed going in now. It's really more of a common stock with a couple extra perks to it. And that, I would think, would be just a couple $1,000. I mean, those are pretty simple.
Okay, very good.
Series A is just a huge jump in my book from a seed.
Okay, very good.
You can really use the standardized documents in the seed much more easily, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Michael Horton, can you talk now? And by the way, the prices we get here in the Southeast are so much better. You should all move here. There's no reason to live anywhere else in the country. So with that, Michael, go ahead.
I mean, I'm like Liz, I mean, being an attorney, and I kind of serve on both sides. And I'll describe kind of both situations. And oftentimes when I represent the company, and often the company basically is going out and getting an angel investment from angels acting individually, which means that the company is preparing all of the offering documents and all of the legal documents. And what I have done there is I basically developed a fee schedule. So I have a three fee packages for that, one for convertible notes, one for Series A, and then I have something what I call kind of test the water package, which is because I have a number of clients that desperately need money, and they're ready to approach individual investors, but they're not sure that they will get the investment. So they're very concerned about spending money, developing all these legal documents, only to find out that they don't use them. So in that package, basically, we help them, prepare, review the executive summary from an SEC disclosure perspective, and then we develop the terms for them and do a term sheet. And, of course, with that, they can get any money since they don't have the legal documents, but the investor basically gets everything that he or she needs to make an investment decision, and then once they're comfortable that there is an interest in the offering, then they come back to us, and then we can, in basically 4 business days, develop the legal documents. For disclosure purposes, the fee schedule there is for Series A is $5,000 for a convertible note, $3,500, and then if you do the test the water package, it's $1,500, and then that gets deducted if you then move into step two, then that gets deducted in the second phase. I also serve on the board and do a lot of legal work for an angel group here in Atlanta, and we have just recently reorganized, and I spent myself a lot of time trying to standardize our documents. We create a dedicated LLC every time we invest, and we have a deal champion. We spend a lot of time negotiating carried interest and how we should divide it and so forth, and it's really a little too early to kind of say, we also developed some standard term sheet. It's a little too early to say kind of what the cost is there. It is relatively new, this whole structure. I can't really give much input there as to, what the legal cost is going to be to that particular angel group.
Okay, very good. Michael, thank you. Sam, any comments on that topic?
Yeah, we're legal fees generally are expensive in our area of the country. First of all, we invest across a broad range of industries, so definitely it's difficult to have a standard. Obviously, there are some core terms that are certainly repeated in deals, but on a deal by deal, it's certainly a lot of different things going on. Frankly, we work closely with. Usually, we try to work closely with counsel that the various firms that we have relationships with that they are on the same page with us in terms of an investment in the company, in the sense that they understand that this is an early stage company and that it can afford expensive legal fees. And so typically speaking, it could be a large firm that has a group that is dedicated towards smaller companies, but typically speaking, it's smaller firms that's their strategy of making essentially the approach of almost viewing this as a marketing expense to develop the relationship with the company or the relationship with the group, and with the hope that further down the line there'd be additional business. So generally we try to cut costs that way. Another way which we work closely with counsel is we have some legal law firms sponsoring the Angel Group, and they part of their what they do is they do the internal work in terms of legal on the Angel Group, and then in general we try to defer a lot of the fees if possible to a round where there's more cash coming in than if you do the small seed stage round, which we're focusing on these days. And you know, even $5,000 to $10,000 goes out to legal, even $5,000, that could be a significant piece of that very early round to the company. So that's sort of the different strategies we look to do.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Sam. John?
Sure. Well, we've got the advantage of having four intellectual property counsel in the group and another five attorneys, three of whom have been general counsel. So our internal review is fairly thorough and quick. That being said, we do on occasion pay for legal services. They're always negotiated up front. When I created the group, I went to a number of law firms in town and appealed to their sense of civic pride. And we get an enormous amount of contributed legal time in an effort to help create new technology-based businesses. So while occasionally we will pay up to $5,000 within a negotiated package and sometimes significantly less, it's probably 3 out of the 18 deals we've done so far. And our philosophy has always been to start with standardized term sheets and boilerplate agreements and then spend our time on customizing the deal structure in order to deal with the risks in the deal and how we can best mitigate our risks in making an investment and whenever possible take the lead on a round so that we can bring in additional groups that might not have the capacity to do due diligence, the time to negotiate a deal, and therefore maximize our clout with that transaction and all the others that follow.
So, John, it sounds like it's very efficient out there. So, did I hear you right that only three of the last eight or more that you've had to pay for legal fees, and a lot of it was contributed for the good of the community?
Yep, 3 out of 18.
Wilson Cincini, if you're listening to this, please take note. So, that's what you should be charging me, in my opinion. Thank you.
Casey McGlynn is a great guy, and he is very generous with his time if you grab him to bend his ear. But I certainly appreciate law firms have got to make their own money. But what we've tried to do, for instance, we do not invest out of our geographies. Our feeling is that as a fund, as an angel fund, our strength is investing locally, bringing our members' talents to add value to the companies that we invest in, and even for those that we turn down, we provide a great deal of detail on why we didn't like the opportunity. Some of those companies have come back to us and addressed those. Others have taken the hit and gone away so that they're not creating sand in the local economy. And I think our overall approach has appealed to law firms, accounting firms, tax organizations, other advisors. And so they're great at giving us deal flow. When we twist their arms only a little bit, they're helpful in providing mentoring for some of these companies. So while we are, as individuals in our firm, very much for profit, our organization operates a little bit more like a nonprofit from an expense standpoint and a charity from a volunteer's time standpoint.
Yeah, sounds very, very efficient. Another topic, but I guess this topic has already been broached by several others, is the standardized docs topic. Obviously, there have been a number of different people who've embarked upon this. I know a number of cities have created their own. There also exists, for the listeners, if you've not gone out there and checked them out, there are several different websites that are very, very interesting. You'll find them in the email that we sent out with the agenda. But they include SeriesSeed.com, that I understand, a whole number of the super angels in California have gone to, and also to, for many in New York. There's the Y Combinator, Series A, Standard Docs. And then there's a couple of other sites, and I haven't looked at their docs myself, but they include standardforms.org and venturedocs.com. I'd be very interested in the panel's opinions, of the usefulness of those external docs, and if they've gone to standardized docs, what has been the source of those docs, and any other words of wisdom there. Rachel?
Yeah, like I said, we do use standardized docs, and unfortunately, we created them internally at pretty significant cost, although I would have gladly used Y Combinators or Techstars or anyone else's. Based on the research that we have done on all of those sites and the documents, ours are not dissimilar from theirs, nor are they to each other. So you're kind of seeing the industry as a whole really adopt some standardization. Quite frankly, especially as it relates to our business, you know, we're trying to develop chapters all across the country. So scale and standardization is just part of what our model has to be, quite frankly, to be successful. So we've had, you know, it's drastically improved our funding timeline. We fund in, you know, 4 to 6 weeks. We'll do 6 deals this year. It's creating that standardization has helped our business tremendously. Although, you know, I'm completely sympathetic and understanding of the fact that each deal is different. You know, like I said, we just start with the template, and then if there's something specific that needs to be altered for a deal, we just deal with that, you know, one specific alteration and not having to draft a whole different term sheet and docs for each deal. So it works for us.
Very, very good. Liz?
And perhaps really some of our investments are really more full course Series A. We do use the NVCA documents sometimes, National Venture Capital Association. They have some forms on their website. There still is, though they are forms, there still are significant choices to be made within those forms. So I'm not really sure. They definitely save time, but maybe not as much as the Series Seed forms do, depending on how much, you know, how far along the company is.
Okay, very good. And Michael, and by the way, for the everyone, Michael volunteered quite a bit of time to help a local angel group down here in the South, and we're, you know, a couple of years ago creating standardized docs, and, you know, Michael, very appreciative of the work you did on that. You know, I'll just say, you know, not sure if I ever thanked you, but thank you. If you could comment as well.
Yeah, I have certainly, I'm familiar with Y Combinator, Series Seed, and I'm very much in favor of that kind of simplified approach. The problem that I've been kind of struggling with here in Atlanta is that these National Venture Capital Association style documents have been used, you know, in these angel rounds for years, and it's just very, very difficult to get people to kind of deviate from that. And as a result, I mean, the standard, and Mike can comment on that as well, is kind of the standard price often charged in these, you know, Series A rounds. It can be between $10,000 and $15,000, and, you know, the documentation is extremely extensive for, you know, for a deal that often is below $1 million. And it's just been hard, but I hope that, you know, over time we'll be able to kind of change the, you know, the attitude.
Yeah, I do want to agree with that completely. I mean, there's been some deals where I've been on as a lawyer and or an investor, and I've tried to get things simplified down, and a lot of the, you know, angel group members or people, you know, who are negotiating it really do expect to get basically what is the same level of protection and complexity that a full venture capital round may have. Now, sometimes these rounds are a couple million dollars, but I don't know how to educate the community up here to get them to really realize that maybe an $800,000 round doesn't, it's just not appropriate to have the same complexity of document. So.
Yeah, I mean, I was just involved as a counsel for, you know, $500,000 deal, and that was, I had to give legal opinions, et cetera. I mean, I think that's just not, really not what it should be. For a small deal like that, to give legal opinion for it, it's such a small deal. But it's just, it's so ingrained in the local community, and that is, I just find it's going to take some time, I'm afraid, to change it. But I am very much in favor of it.
Okay, very good. Clayton, any experience with standardized docs?
Yeah, we pretty much use a set of standardized docs that we have formed over time. We don't use any third-party docs, although we'll tell you they were referenced when ours were being developed. But we try to keep it pretty simple, and I agree with the two previous speakers that sometimes on this level of deal it gets so complicated We found that with the with standardized docs, keeping them as simple as possible, and to tell you the truth, we don't really negotiate the documents. We put it out as an offer to the company, and we don't negotiate the deal. We try to make it as good a deal for the company, as fair for the company as possible, and we really expect a yes or no from the company.
Yes, that's
one way to minimize legal costs.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's that's happening in all the hotbeds, you know, whether it be Silicon Valley and more and more in New York. You know, here are the terms. You know, here are the docs. You know, they are what they are. You know, sign at the bottom if you wish to go through.
Well, yeah, that's pretty much the way we take it. And it works out great. We're not trying to screw any company. And as soon as they get that concept, and the other thing we do is we give them a sample of the term sheet early on so that it's not any surprise to them when you're coming down to actually finalizing the deal.
Yeah, that's great advice. Sam?
We actually have a new, and we've been around since 99, and we've actually, we believe that angel investors are entitled, and there's two choices. You can have high legal fees and, you know, to protect yourself, and you can have lower legal fees and still protect yourself. We believe that in our deal, we do try to protect ourselves, maybe not as strongly as a venture round, but, you know, for some of our angels, it's a significant, you know, investment for them in certain deals, and we do try to make sure to protect ourselves as well as we can. Obviously, we want the deal to be fair for the company, but at the same time, we want it to be fair for the angels. We're in this business to make money. At the end of the day, again, some groups have a different a reason for being a business, but for Tri-State Ventures, the reason is that the angels, the guys who invest, the men and women who invest, want to make money on their deal. And in terms of using standardized documents, what we found is that counsel generally gets on us in terms of using those types of documents. They may have their own standardized documents, the various, you know, but when you start using someone else's, at least for some of the lawyers that we've dealt with, it creates a scenario in which, you know, oh, you're using someone else's documents, and then when it comes down to it, if something ends up going wrong or something ends up needing additional work, there's always, well, use someone else's document. So we're careful to use, we use those documents possibly as a, you know, reference if there's some idea that maybe one of our lawyers didn't think of, or some, you know, term that might be an advantage to us. We may point that out, but typically speaking, we just use those standards documents as a potential resource. We don't actually use them. Unless our lawyer specifically says, hey, grab that document and go ahead and I'll mark it up.
Okay, very good. John?
We started with the NBCA documents about 6 years ago, made some modifications that we thought fit for various classes of investment. And as we've done deals, we've learned a little bit more, tweaked a little more, come up with some of our own terms that we think at least are unique. And when NBCA or we find another document that has something incrementally better, fairer, more balanced, provides protections at low cost, we add those into our standard templates. And we basically go through their process where in each major term there are two or three or four choices, some of them theirs, some of them ours.
And do you hold your companies to be funded to the line in terms of modifications to it?
You know, we are open to negotiation as long as the risk-reward is balanced. We always start out with a very simple term sheet, strive for one page, never exceed two, have good, solid justifications. We don't really have a take-it-or-leave-it philosophy, but, you know, that being said, we've had deals presented to us by companies that had technology we liked and management teams that we liked, but that had valuation and terms that were unrealistic by a factor of three. And it's taken, and because we liked what we saw and we thought it had merit, and it was pretty clear that no sophisticated investor would cut a check, we spent some time with them, and in one case dropped the pre-money from 10 to below 3 and changed the terms so they were more investor-friendly while still allowing the management team to have control as long as they executed according to plan. And so, you know, we like to think we're a little on the creative side relative to terms, but as someone else said, we think angel investors should have all the protections that a venture investor should have, but not necessarily some of the abusive
substantive overages.
Okay, very, very good. John, can I ask you to lead off the next one, because it sounds like you do a great job out there. Talk a little bit about, negotiating fees, flat or bulk or for the good of the community. Also maybe broach stock in lieu of fees or earn carry in lieu of fees or any creative things that you have all done out there.
Well, there are some law firms, accounting firms, and other service providers that will take equity. We've never used that as part of getting a deal done. We find we did try it once. It slowed down the deal significantly. What we do bring is a pretty broad stable of advisors that, if we invest and there's a gap in the virtual team at that company, or there's a weakness in that team that we negotiate in as part of our investment, we can point management towards better resources, broader resources, or new resources that may be willing to do that. But, in a particular deal, that has not been our issue. One, because we've got most accounting, tax, legal expertise in-house, and two, when we've been able to do it because of our pitch to the community and our own work ethic in it. People contribute a lot of time. We've been able to keep those fees relatively low, so that hasn't been required.
Okay, very good. And and Rachel, any things that you've done over there in terms of bulk negotiated discounts or stock in lieu or earned carry in lieu of fees?
No, it was just kind of part of our standardization process when we got the docs, is that, we kind of laid out what the attorneys would do in deviation from the standard docs, and then we capped it at $2,500. So we all have a very clear understanding of what everyone's getting for, what we're paying.
Okay, very good. And then Liz and Michael, probably no need to negotiate against yourselves on that topic.
No. And I do, on occasion, I do take part of my fee in equity. And then I just had one here I closed about a couple of weeks ago where I represented the company and basically took, it was an A round, and basically took, I ended up, I think it's a company that may have a fairly quick exit, so I wanted starting the capital gain period to kick in. So I basically took it in common stock, which may be seen a little strange, but I got obviously a lot more common stock than I would have gotten preferred stock. Plus, I think I can take the position with the IRS that the value I would have to report is a lot less than the fee I kind of would have that is replaced. Mm-hmm. Because there's obviously the value of the common is so, and I did it before we even had any assurance that we would close on the Series A round. And sometimes I take options, but this wasn't a case where I actually ended up taking shares, and I actually ended up deciding that it was more advantageous for me to not take Series A, but taking common.
I probably have a couple things to add in connection with sort of the standardized fees. My firm is Fox Rothschild, and actually three partners here founded Delaware Crossing, though we are full investing members. We are not sponsors or anything like that. Our membership fees are $500 a year because basically they use all the resources here that they can. But we do have this, we instituted this retainer arrangement, even though we're 6 years old, only just this year for the first time. And I'd be curious to know what other people are doing. We're finding that a lot of the legal costs, I mean, in the beginning when you're a baby network, you're just investing, and all you're thinking about is the costs for investing. But now many of our companies are on their second or third round. We're being asked to consent to things. We're being squeezed down. We're being exited. We have one company where the VCs are coming in, and they're clearly breaching their fiduciary duty on the board, and basically all the angels are having to get together and protest. So, there's a lot of legal fees that are not just negotiating the standardized documents that get very complicated and very unique, which is why for the first time we're trying this capped sort of retainer arrangement so that there's unfettered access to legal advice, because the amount of time that we were starting to spend was becoming, enormous. So even though we've never charged a thing in our life to the group. So we're just trying to see what it's about. But what about the other groups? I mean, when you become a more mature group, that really takes as much care and watching. You can lose your money if you don't pay attention to the subsequent rounds and your rights and the exits. You can lose all the money you so carefully invested in the first place. So what about that?
Michael, this is John Alexander. Can I take a shot at that?
Absolutely.
You know, we have a very similar situation coming on now, and never more than now have I found it valuable to have members that are attorneys.
Right.
And I got to tell you, when you've got an attorney, and because of the way we're structured, and we probably analyzed 10 other angel firms around the country before we developed a model that we thought would fit in Minnesota. I don't know if all of you have heard the term Minnesota Nice, but for people from outside of Minnesota, there's a passive aggressiveness associated with their hate behavior here that we thought necessitated the structure in order to get optimum participation. But it's incredibly valuable when individual members who have skills that you need have significant skin in the game. And
right.
So we have an issue like that right now, remarkably similar. And one of our litigators put an additional significant amount of money in through the fund into that deal. And to say he's ticked off does not underestimate his enthusiasm for participating and taking action against others that are all too anxious to step on the angel investors.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
But as a result of our structure and the breadth of the skill set in our organization, you know, we have been able to participate in all follow-on rounds. And we have a cross-fund mechanism that allows us to participate in all follow-on rounds and preserve our preemptive rights to a maximum extent. And, it's early because we're only in our second fund. We've had one liquidity event out of our first fund and one failure, so we have 10 companies running. And it's way too early in our second. So, I'm encouraged that the model seems to be working with minor tweaks between funds, but for those of you that have funds who have members with certain skills, or as you open yourself up to new members, whatever mechanism that might be, and we are only open when we create a new fund and closed in between, we try very hard to have a balanced group of C-level people, service providers, technology, skill sets, and the like, so that we've got a breadth of skills internally.
That's very important.
Good. Thank you for those comments. Any other comments with regard to Liz's point? Okay, very good. Next topic, accounting and bookkeeping fees. Can you all maybe describe how you handle the requirements, auditing, frequency reporting, things of that nature on the accounting and bookkeeping side? Because those can really add up over time. I'm just curious as to what are the more standardized terms in your seed and the A rounds in terms of requirements in the accounting and bookkeeping sides, and what you also might require at closing as well. I'm not sure who might like to take a first crack at that.
I can. Because we actually innovated here recently, and hopefully that can help someone else. And I don't know about the specific laws regarding the states where you are, but in Tennessee, we have a law that allows for what are called series operating companies. So we have actually a master LLC, we call it. And for each deal that we do, we set up a separate operating series within that LLC. So you can think of it kind of like a different class of stock, but it's actually a separate operating entity. And what that's created is a very efficient accounting process at the end of the year. So instead of having to set up a separate LLC for each deal that we do, it all falls under one company. So I won't, bore you with the details of how the cap tables work, because that's where it gets very, very detailed. But from a tax reporting, especially at the federal and then obviously at the state level, it becomes very efficient. The other thing that we have decided after 6 months of research, we've decided just to build internally, is something that tracks our cap tables. Because what we found is incredibly laborious and hard to keep track of the subsequent rounds as our portfolio is aging. More importantly, we want to be able to provide to our investors at any given point in time exactly where their portfolio is. So if they've been in a deal for 2 years and they've done two rounds, we want them to be able to track, implied, although not realized, gains in their portfolio and also losses. So we're having, because if anybody on this call knows of a software platform that does track a portfolio, that would be fantastic, because we were not able to find anything that would track it on a per individual investor basis. There's lots of private equity stuff that tracks it as a full portfolio, but not for, because, you know, not all of our investors are in any one deal. So anyway, we're developing that internally so that we can, you know, better track the portfolio from a mathematical standpoint in the cap table.
Okay, very good. Yeah, that, the valuation fee side, in order to report back to the different shareholders, is a really interesting topic. Let's do that next. In fact, we'll go round robin on that to talk about, you know, how everyone handles their valuation fees and reporting back to the, to their shareholders. But before we get to that topic, any additional you know, thoughts on accounting and bookkeeping fees to keep those reasonable through the year, and what, you know, what do you require in your term sheets and closing docs on an ongoing basis in that regard?
I can remember something this. Okay.
Skip a distinction on the mechanics of closing.
Michael, can you ask that again?
Are we going to have a separate, is that a separate topic that was in your list on the mechanics of closing, or is that something we're covering now, or is that a separate topic?
Yeah, I didn't list it as a separate separate topic in terms of the mechanics of closing. I was just curious as to what was typically required, what types of you know, accounting and bookkeeping terms were, you know, did you all put into your term sheets and closing docs, because of course that then directly reflects on the costs on an ongoing basis servicing the shareholders. Sam or John or Liz?
Well, I would say one thing that in terms of accounting, I mean, with a lawyer, it's, I think, a little less, more difficult. But one of the things we found is when it comes to accounting, we try to avoid using someone in New York. we do someone actually in some of the deals in Texas, and that actually works out well because, you know, they can do what they need to do most of the time. If a trip is needed down there, they down here usually work that well. And the rates are much lower, obviously.
Yeah, we basically found somebody, one of our members has a family office, and they have a part-time accountant, and she does all of our LLC and K-1s, which I wish we had this series thing, because it's ridiculous the number of K-1s we have to send out every year now. But basically my secretary does it, but we have the, you know, which for, you know, for free, but the accountant is really an independent, because it's not that complicated on that side. It's just
time-consuming. Great. Any other
talk? In our site in Minneapolis, our accountant is terribly overqualified as a CFO of a $10 billion fund. And as we were putting it together, we sat down with her and our outside tax people, and I worked up a model that takes care of the structure for how we're organized. But we're organized as one LLC. So every member gets one K-1 every year as opposed to one per deal.
And that's because you're a fund, not a network.
That's correct.
Yeah, we're not.
And every member has skin in the game in every single deal, and whether they put more in is subject to their interest and how much other interest there might be. So the mechanics of doing annual taxes is easier. The process that we put in place is easier. The difficulty is that one portfolio company being late with their K-1s can delay the whole kit and caboodle. But our representative to the board or our observer to the board understands that that's a, you know, primary responsibility is to get that K-1 back to us by the middle of March, no later.
Any other
being a fund, we're pretty similar in the kind of greatly simplified. But one of the things we do, I happen to teach entrepreneurship in an MBA program, so we use a lot of students who are accounting majors and actually set for the CPA, but, and then they're supervised by two of our members that are CPAs. And so the only thing we send out is at the end of the year, we get a third party to do our taxes. And what that resulted in is that our CPA cost last year was $500. So it greatly reduces the cost.
What, you can't beat a price like that. But of course, you've got you've got different rules for accounting down in Louisiana.
we follow all the rules. It's standard GAAP accounting and so forth. But doing month to month, keeping up, as long as they're supervised and so forth, the students actually do a great job.
and it cuts down on the costs greatly because we're up to date on everything when it goes to the outside CPA.
Yeah, well, that's a great experience for the for the kids as well. That's great.
And it does involve the kids quite a bit. Yes. Mm-hmm.
It makes sense. Any other thoughts or topics on keeping accounting and bookkeeping fees down? All right. Let's also talk in terms of this point that was brought up just a few minutes ago on valuation fees in order to report back to the LPs or shareholders as the case may be accurately year after the initial investment. Does anyone engage in valuations to try to size up exactly where that company is for reporting, somewhat accurately? Of course, that's subject to debate as well, but a number, in any case, to their, LPs or shareholders. Any thoughts on that? Yeah, so that's a tougher
one. We do not do updated valuations.
Okay. I guess that could get just incredibly expensive across a portfolio, couldn't it?
Yeah, that's an expensive. The limited value there, because how accurate are they anyway, and the expense of doing it, it's just not worth it for us.
Yeah, makes sense. I think that some of you had mentioned that you do a pooled investor LLC to reduce the number of parties, or I guess in some cases, obviously the funds. It's a moot point. But Rachel, can you talk a little bit more about that master LLC? And do you know if by chance if that's available in many other states?
I know it's available in Delaware.
Yeah, Delaware is the only other one I know. Okay, very good. Yeah, that would save us a lot of money down here, wouldn't it, Michael?
I have to confess, and I have never done one like that. But I know it's, and I've been kind of thinking of looking into it, but I've never done one. And I'd be interested in knowing kind of really what are the savings, are they really, because it costs very little to set up an LLC. And it obviously, the allocation provision must get a lot more complicated. So I wonder whether, that really obviates the savings of creating a separate LLC when you have these more complicated income and loss allocation provisions.
Well, for us, it was terribly significant, to be honest. It was a huge pain to not only set up but then subsequently maintain lots of LLCs. So we had, only three before I was like, this is getting ridiculous. Doing it with a master holding company, for lack of a better word, it's very clearly defined in the law that each one is a separate operating company. We have a master operating agreement for that particular entity, and then we have supplemental agreements for each series. So actually our investors, when it comes to closing, they just sign off on, this is how much I've invested in owner of the funding LLC, and then we, Angel Capital Group, execute all the closing documents on their behalf. So, and then we file one, state and tax return. Now, how it works, accounting-wise, is that basically all those investors, when it comes to K-1 reporting, are lumped into one master cap table. And the complexity of initially setting that up was pretty large, but, it's like anything else. Once you get it going, it just works fine thereafter. We're probably a little bit more invested than most groups in, the portfolio maintenance, because we consider ourselves, a full-service organization. We probably charge more fees than, I think, anyone else in the country. So, for that, we try to provide a lot of value, and that goes into, especially if the company has done a subsequent round, we want to make sure that we're tracking that for our investors. So.
Very, very good. Any other thoughts on that topic? Changing over to the next topic, has anyone ever experimented with the online offering systems or online editing and signing automation systems? I think in our email, we had mentioned a few like ProFounder, DocuSign, Right Signature, Contractually, EchoSign. Obviously, there's a whole bunch of them out there. But any experiences? Has anyone played around with those automated offering systems or automated editing and signing automation systems?
We do. And I'm also going to plug one of our portfolio companies, which is a company called Synex. Their clients are Google and IBM, so they do large enterprise solutions, but they'll be coming out with one that hopefully we can all use called MyDocs
here in the next couple of months. But we've been using DocuSign for a year and a half or so, and it's been a fantastic app that we do absolutely everything that we close or sign, we do through DocuSign.
And the costs are pretty low, aren't they?
Yeah, I think we only pay $50 a month, like a $49.95 or something subscription. It's almost nothing.
And what does it do, DocuSign? What do you get for that?
You would upload a PDF, and you kind of have a, and then you tell it who the signers are going to be by email, and then you drag and drop signature tags onto the PDF, and then it emails it out to all the recipients. The recipients get the email, they click on a link, they sign it, all electronically, and then once all parties have completed it, everybody gets an original document. So it's fantastic.
Does it try to help handle the negotiation of terms within the agreement, or does it assume you've got a final PDF for everyone to sign, and that's the extent of it?
We don't use it for negotiations. I mean, it's probably a good solution to that would be, a Google Doc or something that everyone would have access to, and then some sort of tracking changing. We just use it specifically for closing, use it for a member agreement. I mean, anything that we have signed, we do it all electronically through DocuSign.
Okay, that makes sense. Anyone else, use an online system for closing or?
I mean, I've been using EchoSign. I've tried that, experiment a little bit with that, and I'm not sure it's as sophisticated as DocuSign, but it's fairly similar. I've also been using Adobe, and has it's called the e-signature that works pretty well. And that's certainly, I mean, this year I basically kind of handle all my closings kind of electronically. I have all my clients basically that are going to, equity financing. They basically adopt, uncertificated shares, so we don't have to shuffle share certificates around. And then all the documents are basically, they're put in a big PDF Adobe file and basically put a digital stamp on it so it can be changed and sent it to, to the investor, and then they basically sign a what I call an omnibus signature page. That's an investor questionnaire that basically, whereby they basically adopt all of the documents, and then when the company receives that and accepts the subscription, it just basically sends them an ownership statement, whereby the company signs all of the documents that are in the PDF file they already have. So that's kind of the way that I've been doing it, and it's probably even more efficient to do what Rachel has been doing using this DocuSign.
Very good. By the way, if anyone from the audience has any questions, just hit *6 on your phone to unmute your mic, and just go ahead and ask your question. Just be loud so that we hear you. Again, just press *6 to unmute your mic, and then just go ahead and ask your questions.
Hi, Michael. This is Paul Ipoldero. So for those of us that are, I would call, less than institutional kind of investors, I'm very intrigued with this because I'm just going through a closing now, and the amount of paperwork and things to sign is, like, staggering. And there's, like, this poor company is trying to keep track of 50 different investors. And, of course, there's one guy on vacation that's lost his homework and blah, blah, blah. So what do you guys recommend for those of us following at home? How do I mute, by the way?
And then to go back to mute, it's just the same thing, just *6, and that'll mute you again.
Okay.
Any advice from the panel?
I still recommend DocuSign highly, again, of course. I think that the gentleman who's using Adobe, that's actually Synex, our portfolio company, Adobe, uses their e-signature solution. So, but DocuSign, once you use it once, you just upload the PDF, you tell it who you need to sign, and then it handles the rest. So I highly recommend that.
And, Paul, thank you for asking your question. I should have paid more attention to the clock and allowed more time for the audience questions, so I apologize for that. Looking at the bewitching hour, it looks like we're almost near the end, so just some quick final remarks. First of all, I'd like to thank our panelists for sharing their thoughts with so many angels across North America today. Your involvement and dedication to entrepreneurism sets a high benchmark for others to follow. On behalf of all the angel groups that were able to join us across North America, we really appreciate your efforts. Thank you so much for agreeing to speak. Also, some upcoming events. Everyone on the call today may listen to past events and participate in future events at no charge. You may see a full listing of future events at angelpool.org. Again, that's angelpool.org, and then just click on the Knowledge tab. There are a number of high-profile speakers and panels coming up that will be discussed. We'll be discussing various aspects of angel investing and best practices. The next few events are on August 26th. We've got Josh Koppelman, managing partner of First Round in Philadelphia. On September 8th, we've got Reid Hoffman, a partner of Greylock and, of course, chairman of LinkedIn. On September 22nd, we've got a diligence panel, What Matters and Best Practices. So those are the next a few, again, all at no charge. This call was recorded, and it should be available for you to pass to any of your fellow angels by tomorrow. So, again, you can just check the angelpool.org site, and it should be ready tomorrow if you'd like to pass it on if there is some good knowledge. And with that, this call is now concluded. Thank you all, and have a great day.
What's that website again?
Oh, I'm sorry, angelpool.org, and it's kind of hard to hear because of all the disconnections. There's so many callers, but yeah, angelpool, as in swimming pool, .org.
All right, thank you.
Thank you all. Bye.
You're about to end this meeting. You're the only person still in the meeting.